Hello, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Welcome to Lungcast. It is Lung Cancer Awareness Month, a time for clinicians and patients alike to reflect on the need for better recognition and earlier diagnosis of the deadliest cancer in both men and women. There are an estimated 230,000 new lung cancer cases in the U.S. this year, and another 136,000 deaths from the disease. Therapies and diagnostics have made great strides in past years, with targeted mutation therapies and immunotherapy, and the rising availability of low-dose CT screening. There are community campaigns to raise lung cancer awareness and financial support to advance further research to keep closing the gaps in knowledge and care for the patients affected by this lethal disease. Prevention of lung cancer by further identifying risk factors and promoting risk reduction behaviors and making earlier diagnosis of lung cancer are leading to increased survival. Today, we're going to talk about another dimension in our fight against lung cancer, and that is cancer interception. Cancer interception is the active way of combating cancer and carcinogenesis at earlier and earlier stages. The formalization and adoption of lung cancer interception strategies could help clinicians reach an era when they move from mostly treating cancer to actually preventing it. This month's episode features a tag team of tremendous researchers, Dr. Avi Spira and Dr. Stephen Dubinet. They have delivered years of individual and collaborative work toward the betterment of lung cancer care, which we're excited to share with you today. Together, Drs. Spira and Dubinet co-lead an alliance of 35 international researchers as the Lung Cancer Interception Dream Team. This research is funded jointly by the American Lung Association, Stand Up to Cancer, and Longevity. Few experts could better guide discussion around lung cancer interception, and we're happy to share our platform with them today. We hope you enjoy. I want to start out and say that it's hoped that one day cancer will be viewed as a chronic condition that can be largely prevented, detected early, and eliminated in its early stages. Whereas right now, about 90% of the emphasis is on cancer treatment, it's been said that the emphasis will ultimately be on prevention and treatment of those cases that sneak through. A common perception is that cancer risk reduction is passive, such as not smoking, is the active way of combating cancer and carcinogenesis at earlier and earlier stages. The cancer biology behind cancer interception is increasingly solid, as was written in an article in 2011 by Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn, who won the 2009 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. And as you know, we've been fortunate to have her as part of our review team for the Dream Team research that we're about to talk about today. And for my audience, we are speaking with the principal investigators of one of the cancer interception dream teams regarding lung cancer. This is a multi-year project that's been funded by the American Lung Association in conjunction with Stand Up to Cancer and Longevity. Before we get to the science, I would just like to get a little background on our team leaders, Dr. Avi Spira and Dr. Stephen Dubinet, who both have strong interests and presence in translational research. Dr. Dubinet is director of the UCLA Clinical and Translational Science Institute and associate vice chancellor and senior associate dean for translational research, building on original discoveries relevant to inflammation and immunity in lung cancer. He developed a translational research program which utilizes these laboratory-based discoveries in the translation and clinical environment. Dr. Spira is a professor of medicine, pathology, and bioinformatics at the Alexander Graham Bell Professor in Healthcare Entrepreneurship at Boston University. He has built a translational research program that focuses on genomic alterations associated with smoking-related lung disease, leading to a molecular test for the early detection of lung cancer that has successfully translated into the clinic. So I'd like to open it up to both of you just to give us a little background and how you got into that area and that field, and ultimately what drew you together to become collaborators in such an important research project. Right. Steve, would open up with you or Avi?
I can kick it off real quick and hand it over to Steve. So yeah, I'm a pulmonary and critical care physician, and very early in my career, actually in training, had the experience of taking care of a lot of patients that were diagnosed with lung cancer. Often I was the one making the diagnosis clinically, and usually it was at a very advanced stage where there was very little we could offer to them in terms of a chance for cure. And I think that clinical experience and unmet need really motivated me to spend my time doing research on better ways that we can diagnose and detect lung cancer early. And that really led to a large genomic program in my lab in that space and some potentially important biomarkers that are making their way into the clinic. But maybe most importantly, I had the great fortune of being at a conference in Europe with Steve. I don't know, it was 15 years ago or so, Steve, where we both were attending a meeting somewhere in Europe. I can't remember the city right now, and got to meet Steve for the first time. And it was very, very clear to me that we shared the same passion for transforming the trajectory of lung cancer in the clinic. And what Steve brought to the table that was truly inspiring was the ability to go literally end to end from very, very basic research into carcinogenesis, translating those insights into patient care impact. And one of the few people in the field that I'd seen truly go end to end. And that's what excited me about collaborating with him.
So I also trained as a pulmonary and critical care physician. And during my training at Mass General, I had the opportunity to do research in a pathology laboratory. Just as we gained access to recombinant IL-2, began what was the first tumor-infiltrating lymphocyte trial for patients with cancer, treating melanoma, renal cell, and lung cancer. And we saw remarkable responses, of course, in those early studies in melanoma and renal cell cancer, but not in lung. And so when I came to UCLA, I began to study why that was the case, why lung cancer was excluded from the anti-tumor responses for immunotherapy. And that really grew to a more full understanding of the nature of immune suppression in lung cancer. But very importantly, more recently, in collaboration with Avi Spira, the concept that this immune suppression begins at the very earliest points of the development of lung cancer provides us not only a scientific understanding of the disease, but a pathway to move forward and to treat early and to move into the concept of interception.
As we know, unfortunately, lung cancer is the number one leading cause of cancer death, both in this country and worldwide. And that's been a significant mission of the American Lung Association to promote awareness, advocate for better treatments, and more importantly, support research like we're doing with the DREAM team. The Interception DREAM team is really complementing strategies to help prevent patients from developing cancer, lung cancer in general. And I know you have several aims as part of your collaborative research. The first one I'll mention and then I'd like you to comment on is creating this atlas of precancerous lesions of the lung that might be able to identify the types of precancerous lung tissue that will require more aggressive treatment. Can you expound more on that aim one and how you're developing this atlas and how it's going to be clinically put to some use?
You know, lung cancer, that we've had enormous advances in treating late stage disease in the last 10 to 15 years, truly transforming our treatment plan in large part due to our fundamental understanding of the molecular biology of late stage tumors, the genomic changes in the tumors themselves, and maybe even more importantly, the changes in the immune microenvironment around the tumor. And that's really translated into tremendous clinical benefit to patients with late stage disease. If we want to try to really change intercepting lung cancer and treating it earlier, a fundamental gap in our knowledge base is what are the earliest cellular molecular changes that take a normal lung epithelial cell and allow it to become precancer and ultimately an invasive cancer. And so that's really the motivation behind the first aim of our DREAM team, which is to develop a so-called precancer atlas for lung, both in squamous cell and in adenocarcinoma, the two commonest subtypes of the disease. And the concept here is to put together very unique cohorts of patients that have precancerous lesion in their airway or lung and are being followed over time to see whether those lesions progress on to invasive cancer and study those lesions with the best molecular profiling tools that we have available at our disposal today. And so that's really the goal of that project. In terms of translation, we believe the findings, and we can talk about some of the specific findings to date, but those findings are going to provide insights into novel targets that we can go after to intercept someone before they develop fully blown lung cancer. So the concept here is to find folks at a pre-malignant stage of disease and then provide them with some sort of intervention so they never develop fully blown invasive lung cancer.
I think the word ATLAS is perfect for what we're doing in these investigations, because it's really to create that roadmap of where we need to go in this disease. And really understanding what we're treating is a prerequisite for really making significant progress on the translational front. As Avi described, we're really trying to catch up to the universe of data and information that's been provided by research for established and advanced disease. With the help of the Lung Cancer Interception Dream Team funding, we're actually able to bring pre-malignancy, early stage disease, how we develop lung cancer in the beginning, develop that roadmap, so we'll be able to actually translate this to something meaningful in the prevention of late disease.
Just a question from my standpoint as a more clinical pulmonologist doing bronchoscopies most of my career. Is the goal of this ATLAS ultimately be something that would help me as a pulmonologist doing a bronchoscopy, recognizing something that I have to then relate back to your ATLAS and then help direct me in next steps as far as appropriate biopsies, appropriate biomarkers, et cetera?
Yeah, I think actually, that is one of the potential translational impacts of the ATLAS that Steve just described. If we are able to do bronchoscopies, collect pre-malignant samples, especially in squamous cell, where we know we can access the lesions in the central airways on bronchoscopy, and understand and distinguish the good actors from the bad actors. That is to say, not all pre-malignant on bronchoscopy are destined to become an invasive lung cancer. So if our ATLAS can help us develop molecular tools and biomarkers that are predictive which of those lesions are destined to progress, then you as a bronchoscopist, when you go in and sample a premalignant area of the airway, potentially would have additional tools at your disposal to make clinical decisions. Which of those patients do I need to intervene upon to prevent a lung cancer in the future? And which of the patients I can just watch, and they're not unlikely to go on and develop an invasive lung cancer. So to me, that's one direct potential clinical impact on bronchoscopy and pulmonologists. Obviously, the second would be if we come up with novel targets to use to intervene upon the bad actors, those that are aggressive, that would even be a further impact in the clinic.
I think also what we have the opportunity for, I think in the near future, will be the ability to not only treat diagnosed during that bronchoscopy, but perhaps treat as well. And I think the advent of robotic bronchoscopy and some of the newer modalities will really enable us, first of all, to get out into the periphery of the lung with greater accuracy, but also to have these tools that Avi mentioned to diagnose and then treat and perhaps revolutionize what we've been doing all these years with diagnostic bronchoscopy to bring treatment to the table.
In the same regard about this ATLAS, we hear a lot about concerns over, we do screening in populations that are at high risk, the smoking identified population. Are some of the things you're working on going to be able to translate into finding cancers earlier in that non-smoking population who may present for other reasons, but yet still have changes in their airway? Are you finding there's similarities in the non-smoker and smoker population?
That's a really good question. The focus so far, at least for the central airway lesions and the cohorts that we are following in our pre-cancer ATLAS, are predominantly either current or former smokers. So I think a lot of the findings to date are clearly in smoking-related squamous cell lung cancer, at least in the central airways. I do believe as we start looking more and more at adenocarcinoma and premalignant adenocarcinoma lesions, which Steve's group has really pioneered how to find those patients and those samples, I think it does give us the opportunity to begin to look at premalignant changes in the non-smoking population who are at risk for adenocarcinoma. And I'll let Steve talk about some of the methods he's using, but I do believe we have the potential to impact the way we diagnose and potentially intercept premalignant patients who are non-smokers with adenocarcinomas. But Steve, let me throw it over to you.
Yeah, I think, Al, that the problem of non-smoking lung cancer is major and, you know, becoming more and more important as we go along, and some of the smoking decreases, we're seeing more and more non-smoking lung cancer. And everything that we're doing now in tobacco-related disease also helps us in the sense of understanding what are the technologies we need to use and the bioinformatic approaches in terms of identifying the important immune mediators and the nature of immune suppression that causes tumor cells to be missed at the very earliest stages. I think our colleagues in computational medicine are becoming more and more adept at helping us understand what the genomic features are of us as individuals that may predispose us to the disease. And I think as we move along, we'll be able to have clues within our own genes in terms of who the susceptible populations are and how we might be able to include in some sophisticated way in much more exact screening, and that could lead to much more exact precision prevention for those who are really at risk. Right now, we know a lot, much more about smoking-related lung cancer, but over time, I think we'll be catching up and having something meaningful for those who are at risk but don't smoke.
I'd like to move on to the second aim that's listed in your research project. I'll just read it here, is the identify molecular and imaging markers that distinguish malignant from benign indeterminate pulmonary nodules and circulating DNA markers that predict tumor recurrence. Can you break that down a little bit and describe what you're doing in that regard?
Yeah, I'll kick it off, Al. So, you know, the best chance we have in 2020 at finding lung cancer at the earliest possible stage is having someone undergo a CT scan of their chest, either for screening purposes, which is now standard of care, of course, in those above a certain age with a certain history of tobacco exposure, or done incidentally for some other reason. And on that CT scan, finding a so-called pulmonary nodule, you know, a rounded opacity of a certain size that might represent the earliest stage of lung cancer where we have the greatest chance for cure. The challenge is, there's a very high false positive rate on those CAT scans of the chest. There are about 1.5 million pulmonary nodules found every year in this country on CT scans of the chest. The vast, vast majority of those 1.5 million nodules are benign. And so this is the proverbial needle in the haystack. How do we identify the subset of those nodules that truly represent early stage lung cancer where we want to intervene with a chance for cure? And so the goal of our second aim is to develop molecular and imaging-based biomarkers that can help distinguish nodules that are benign from those that are malignant that we want to intervene upon, allowing us to intervene more quickly and potentially cure early stage lung cancer. And importantly, avoid unnecessary procedures in those individuals who've been screened for lung cancer and have benign disease. So very, very important clinical so what's. So in that aim, we are working on molecular biomarkers that can be measured in samples from swabbing your nose, from blood samples, as well as the imaging itself, looking at the CT scan with novel artificial intelligence machine learning techniques to identify the characteristics of the nodule that are predictive of it having a malignant or benign behavior. And ultimately, in this grant, we want to integrate the imaging with the molecular biomarkers to have the most robust predictor of cancer status for those indeterminate pulmonary nodules.
And I think from the standpoint of one of the goals of the American Lung Association, we know that lung cancer screening is not being taken up at the rate that we all would like it to. And some of that pushback has been, just as you said, Avi, finding a nodule, not knowing what exactly it is, not wanting to run the risk of an unnecessary procedure. But it sounds like what you're doing is developing less invasive techniques to be able to make that determination so somebody doesn't have that risk of going to surgery unnecessarily, which I think would be a great thing for screening in general.
Oh, that's exactly right, Al. So about 5% of folks who are eligible for screening in the United States today undergo annual CT screening. Adoption has not been strong yet. And one of the reasons, undoubtedly, is the challenge of managing the false positives that occur when you screen. So this aim specifically is targeting reducing unnecessary procedures in folks that have false positive findings on their CT scans.
And I think your third aim is similar, but I'll let you explain it a little bit more. This is to develop molecular biomarkers to enable precision interception approaches in ongoing clinical trials. Now, I'm assuming this is before anybody has a potential lung lesion that's worrisome for cancer. Is that correct? Or where do we stand with that?
Yeah. So I'll kick it off and also hand it over to Steve on this one. We're actually starting that aim in folks with established early stage lung cancer. And there are two different settings that we're trying to develop these biomarkers to help guide the treatment of early stage lung cancer. The first is collaborating with Charlie Swanton, an oncologist in the UK, who is developing novel biomarkers that predict the risk of recurrence after surgery for early stage lung cancer. So early stage lung cancer is the best chance for curing the disease, but even with the gold standard of treatment, which is surgical resection, about a third of patients have a recurrence of their cancer within a few years of surgery. So the goal there with Charlie is to develop circulating tumor DNA-based tests, liquid biopsies, that can help predict after you've had surgery for an early stage lung cancer, whether you're at high risk for recurring. And if you are, enroll you into a clinical trial where we're giving immunotherapy, drugs that activate the immune system to prevent that individual from getting a recurrence, called so-called adjuvant treatment after surgery. So that's one of the two places we're playing with biomarkers for guiding early stage interception treatments. The second is a partnership with Julie Brammer at Johns Hopkins, where we're taking folks, again, who have early stage lung cancer, where they're moving immunotherapy in the neoadjuvant, so-called neoadjuvant setting, which means they're getting it perioperatively. They're getting treatment prior to surgery with immune activating agents and then undergoing surgical resection. And where our grant comes in is helping work with Julie on developing molecular and imaging biomarkers that would predict which of those individuals with early stage lung cancer are most likely to benefit from getting immunotherapy prior to surgery.
Sure. I think, you know, this space and the initial results with neoadjuvant therapy, immunotherapy before surgery are very encouraging. And the fact that we have more efficacy very early on really is a demonstration of something that's been hypothesized for quite some time, and that is that our immune systems early on in the disease are much more robust. And if cancer progresses, that limits the immune response against the tumor. So I think the initial results from neoadjuvant therapy that we're doing in the context with the DREAM team and others who are doing this around the world really suggest, in fact, that this is a phenomenal opportunity that we anticipate will change standard of practice in the near future and enable us to have a real impact on what is our most affected therapy to date, and that's surgery. But as Avi mentioned, it has its limitations in that so many patients are coming back with metastatic disease subsequently.
And let me add, Al, while the focus in this grant is on early stage lung cancer and guiding treatments with biomarkers there, to your question, the ultimate objective is to move this into the pre-malignant setting, So the learnings here around biomarkers that predict who best responds to immunotherapy preoperatively hopefully serves as a springboard for moving immunotherapy and those types of treatments into the premalignant state and biomarkers that might work there to predict responders as well.
I've been fortunate the last few years to be able to follow your research and be on the review teams and listen in. And I find it, and you alluded to this already, you have a tremendous team, both nationally and internationally, working on this. And it almost seems like it's a logistically hard to mobilize it and keep it under control, but you've done a great job. But I wanted you to have just touch on any unexpected hurdles that came along these last 2.5 years. And then more importantly, any unanticipated surprises that came out of your research.
I'll tackle the hurdles and give Steve the surprises. How about that? We'll divide and conquer. So no, I think out to your point, one of the most unique features of our dream team compared to other dream teams is the size and scope of the team that's been assembled internationally to take on this challenge. And I think it reflects how difficult it is to really intercept lung cancer. And now you have to build the coalition of the willing. And with Steve, and I give Steve a lot of credit here, what Steve and I did at the very, very beginning of the process is identify those individuals that we wanted to bring together across the globe and be able to bring them under a single umbrella, which is very hard to do. And that's really a credit to the funding vehicle that the American Lung Association, Stand Up to Cancer, and Longevity set up, where groups that normally compete with each other in the space were able to come together and work as a single team. So that's been actually a phenomenally positive experience for me over the last 3 years to be a part of that, you know, dream team. I'd say in terms of hurdles, probably related to that is the concept, and you've already alluded to it, of how do you keep the group working together on the same page? And in particular, how do you work with sharing data across groups? How do you work with common data elements, so-called what we call something at one hospital, one medical center, maybe different than what it's called in another medical center? So how does the clinical data get brought together so that the whole is bigger than the sum of the parts? To really take advantage of the synergies by having these exceptional groups working together. So I think one of the, that's definitely been a hurdle for us. And one of the ways we've tried to overcome that hurdle is really making a concerted effort to hire folks that can serve as glue. They can bring the team together, interact on a very frequent interval with all of the players, and importantly, make an effort to come up with this a data dictionary, quite frankly, a set of common data elements that we all use uniformly across the sites for what we call things. And equally important, have a way of sharing samples and sharing data. As I mentioned, that's challenging. There are material transfer agreements, there are intellectual property issues, there are logistical challenges. And we have spent a considerable amount of energy and resource on ensuring that we have the infrastructure in place now to do this right. And that's been one of the big challenges, but also one of the big opportunities in our first 3 years.
I agree with that. And I think I would just add, in terms of what are some of the unanticipated surprises, I think there's several. One is when Avi and I first met, I think it was in Sweden 12 or 14 years ago, if he had said to me, you know, that we're going to be able to pull together an international team to study premalignancy in the very earliest events in lung cancer in order to intercept it before it actually becomes invasive disease, I actually would have said to him, you're dreaming. And so we've come full circle now and have something called the Dream Team. And in so many ways, what actually surprises me is a little bit of what Avi was talking about in terms of, despite these difficulties that are inherent in having multiple institutions internationally, we've been able to have goodwill and collaboration because of the importance of this question to the field and the possibility that will actually impact people's lives. I think the second thing that has come as somewhat of a surprise is how the Dream Team funding in lung cancer interception has really sparked the imagination of other funding agencies and created actually an entire field in which now the National Cancer Institute, other foundations, there's now a tremendous interest in studying the very earliest parts of this disease and translating it to something meaningful. So I think in addition to our work alone, I think ALA longevity and Stand Up to Cancer should be credited with essentially lighting the match that started an entire field of investigation that I think will be meaningful, really meaningful for patients.
Well, thank you for that. But I also wanted to say that it's good to see that. I know the ALA, we always want to fund more research. We feel that all research dedicated to cancer can help all the different cancer types out there. A rising tide raises all boats. And I think learning from what lung cancer interception dream teams do, and also what the pancreatic dream team can do, sounds like there's some synergism that everybody learns from each other. It is a bigger community getting this done. So thank you for your contribution to that. I also wanted to bring up the fact this is probably over asked many times, but in this lung cancer awareness in November of 2020, how has the COVID pandemic affected, if any way, the research you're doing right now? Any comments on that regard?
Yeah, I mean, like all aspects of our life, COVID has had a significant impact on cancer research, I think throughout the country, throughout the world, and specifically an impact on the research that we've been doing through this dream team. There have been challenges with enrolling patients into our studies and collecting biospecimens, where major academic medical centers are often right now on pause in terms of those clinical studies and collecting specimens. In addition, many of our labs at the academic medical centers in this grant have shut down, at least for a period, the ability to do some of the molecular profiling techniques. So there has been a slowdown there. I think on the positive side, things have started to reopen in recent months. So I think we're beginning to see some improvement there, but obviously the next few months is a little bit uncertain. I think one of the silver linings, though, in what COVID has done in terms of pausing, clinical trial enrollment and maybe some of the molecular profiling techniques, is it's expanded our attention on computational techniques for analyzing data that's already been generated. One of the wonderful things about computational biology is pandemic can't stop that, right? It can happen at a distance. It is a virtual exercise. And we've now had the opportunity to really look at our data in a number of different ways that we may not have if there hadn't been a pandemic. And one example of that is looking at our data from the perspective of COVID itself, of the virus itself, and using these very large data sets from airway and lung samples that have been collected from at-risk individuals and asking, can we use that information to understand the biology of COVID, since COVID is a respiratory tract infection? And we've made some really interesting observations related to smoking behavior, for example, and some of the receptors on epithelial cells that are responsible for COVID getting into the cell. So I think the computation is actually accelerated during the pandemic and provided new insights that go beyond lung cancer that are directly relevant to the SARS infection and potentially relevant to lung cancer patients who are, of course, at risk, increased risk for this infection.
Yes, I think Avi described it well. And I think that I think from the immunology side, we're actually able to study the risk factor of COPD in terms of how the inflammatory response may make those patients with COPD more susceptible to bad outcomes. I think what we learn from that will be important in terms and perhaps really applicable to lung cancer, in the sense that the inflammation involved in that process may have some things that we can learn about the inflammation in COPD that makes one susceptible to lung cancer. So I think all of that may be something that can be an advantage to us in a time where so much of the research establishment has turned toward figuring out severe disease in COVID-19.
I know we're coming up on the end of our discussion here. Just wanted to see if there's any specific comments you wanted to make that we hadn't touched upon. We all know this is Lung Cancer Awareness Month, and I know my listeners are kind of excited to hear about some of the things you're doing, because it's hopefully going to be translated into better patient care in the years to come. So any closing comments from either of you?
I would just want to amplify something Steve said earlier and take it one step further. You know, in the last 10 years, there have been unprecedented changes in how we manage folks with late stage lung cancer that have impacted their survival significantly, from targeted therapy now to immunotherapy. Unimaginable 15 years ago that we would have seen that quick of an improvement in our care for late stage disease. I think the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to see similar accelerated improvements in the management of early stage disease, and maybe a little bit beyond that, the idea that we can actually intercept the disease before it starts. So I'm incredibly optimistic about the future of both lung cancer research and ultimately the translation of the research into the impact of the care for folks with early stage disease to start, and ultimately folks that don't even yet have lung cancer. And that, you know, we're going to look back one day, and maybe it's 20, 30 years from now, and say, I can't believe we waited till someone actually had invasive lung cancer to start treating them.
Oh, I agree. And we have now, I think, that we're at the doorstep of the transformation in the care of lung cancer in a way that we, I agree, hadn't previously anticipated, in that the knowledge gained from the research that we're doing with the Lung Cancer Interception Dream Team is leading to a different viewpoint about the nature of the disease will provide us opportunities to treat early, to prevent, and to understand what we're preventing in a way that will profoundly impact the lives of individuals at risk and those with early stage disease.
I think you've both given us a great, uplifting, and optimistic message in Lung Cancer Awareness Month based on what you're doing. We know it's the number one cancer killer of both men and women, but thanks to the work you're doing, there's going to be better days ahead. Thank you for your time today, and look forward to talking more with you in the future.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you again for the incredible support of the American Lung Association in our attempts to intercept this devastating disease. And thank you.
Very welcome.
Thank you.
We'd like to thank Drs. Spira and Dubinet, not only for leading today's fascinating discussion, but for leading the tireless and remarkable efforts of our Lung Cancer Interception Dream Team. It is through ambitious, driven, and collaborative clinicians like them that the unattainable in lung cancer interception now appears in reach. We're excited to see what their work brings in the coming years. This concludes the fourth episode of Lungcast. As we draw 2020 to a close, we hope you've had a chance to listen to all of our Lungcast guests and are looking forward to what we have in store. For a lot of reasons, this has been an unprecedented year in respiratory medicine and research. We are going to keep you guessing, hopefully anticipating for now, what our next topic and guest will be in December as we close out the year and plan on further stimulating issues to discuss in 2021. Until then, this is Dr. Albert Rizzo reminding you, if you can't breathe, nothing else matters. So just take it one breath at a time.